News and features from around Australia and around the world. This is Travel Radio Australia. Here's your host and travel guide, Ren Zviers.
Welcome to this month's edition of Travel Radio Australia. On the show this time, we'll have Jeff Harrison visiting Trentino in northern Italy. I believe the skiing's pretty good there. David Gordon, our Northern Ireland correspondent, is visiting Newport, Rhode Island, across the ditch, the Atlantic ditch I'm talking about, and the Newport Museum of, would you believe it, Irish history. Makes sense. We'll have that segment, and then we'll feature a segment from Travel Writers Radio Melbourne, Graham Kemlow, speaking with his cruise guru, Caroline Jasinski, one of the contributors to that show. And to finish the program this month, Around the World Travel TV, based in Santa Barbara, California. And we'll have the team there, Arthur von Wiesenberger, Martha Bull, and Rebecca Brand, with Ivor Davis, who's written a fascinating book about his experiences being on tour with the Beatles. And that's all happening on this month's edition of Travel Radio Australia. Let's get started with the show. Here's Jeff Harrison.
My guest this week is from Italy, in fact the Italian Alps area, and it's Elisabetta Gutera. Is that correct?
Yes, hello, hi everyone.
And you have a fantastic area of high country called Trentino in northern Italy, I believe, and it's a fantastic place for skiers and high country alpine enthusiasts. Tell us a bit about the area.
Trentino is a little area in the northeast of Italy, close to the border with Austria, and it stretches from the northern part of Lake Garda, which is the biggest lake in Italy, to the Dolomites, which are UNESCO World Heritage Sites, beautiful mountain chain, and it's a all-year-round destination, but it's, let's say, the winter and summer are the most interesting seasons for activities. During the winter time, all winter sports are available, especially downhill skiing or snowboarding and snowshoeing for, you know, people who don't want to go skiing. And we have more than 8 big resorts most of all, we have 2 big circuits. One is the Dolomiti Super Ski, which is one of the biggest ski circuits in the world, the ski domains in the world. It's about 1,200 kilometers of slopes. And on the other side of the region, we have Skirama Dolomiti Adamello Brenta, which is another big ski domain, which groups about 8 resorts for a total of about 400 kilometers. In the summertime, it's an outdoor playground, so you've got plenty of opportunities for all kinds of activity holidays like hiking, mountain biking, climbing, paragliding, or just, you know, relaxing on the shores of one of our 300 lakes.
Absolutely beautiful. And Elisabetta, some of your favorite places to go in the region. I know it's, you're spoiled for choice there. A couple of your favorite resorts to start off with.
Well, that's a very difficult question. If we're talking about winter time, one of my favorite resorts is Madonna di Campiglio, which is a very nice upmarket resort in the Skirama Dolomiti ski domain. And it's a lovely resort with about 150 kilometers of slopes, all connected. And it stretches from the little resort of Pinzolo to Madonna and to Val di Sole. And it also hosts one of the downhill alpine World Cup, the Men's Night Slalom. It takes place on the 22nd of December. Another destination that I really love in the wintertime is Val di Fassa, which is among the Dolomiti Super Ski. And I strongly suggest the Sella Ronda, which is a beautiful tour that runs all around 5 Dolomite passes.
Yes, and what about the summer activities? A couple of places. I know there's some beautiful lakes and all sorts of things like that.
Yeah, indeed. Well, Lake Garda is, of course, our calling card, our best-selling destination. It's the biggest lake in Italy, and our part in the north is the ideal destination for windsurfers, for people loving sailing, because of a constant wind that we have during the day, so it's the perfect base. And also because in the north of the lake, motorboats are not allowed, so also in terms of safety, that is the ideal destination. And another beautiful place is Lake Molveno, always in the Brenta Dolomites, which is a beautiful alpine lake where you can, you know, either swim or just, you know, relax yourself. Or if you're if you like sports, you can also do a jog all around the lake.
And I know that some people might be concerned if they're going to Italy that they have to speak Italian, but most people, it's very easy for English speakers there, isn't it?
Yes, of course, everyone speaks English. Maybe some may speak better than others, but now, you know, our region is devoted to tourism, and of course we need to speak other languages. We can't have, you know, just Italian speaking people, so it's no worry. And then of course, you know, we are Italians, and so we try to make our guests feel at home, and we try our best to, even if maybe the English is not top, they can make themselves understood very well.
And the food and wine must be fantastic in the region.
Yeah, as I said, it's Italy, so food and wine is our thing as well. We in the region, we produce a lot of wines. We are one of the biggest producers of spumante, which is a sparkling wine, but produced like a champagne with the classic method. And we produce about 8 million bottles a year, 30% of the whole Italian production of spumante.
That's fantastic. And how can people find more about Trentino area online, Elisabetta?
Well, just have a look at our website, visittrentino.it, and you will find all the information you need. You will also be able to book your accommodation online.
And can you say in Italian, we look forward to seeing you in Trentino in the future?
Arrivederci in Trentino.
Very easy. Thank you very much. Elisabetta Gotera, from the marketing manager for Trentino area of Northeast Italy. Thank you very much for being on the program.
Thank you, and we look forward to welcoming you to Trentino soon.
That was Jeff Harrison with Elisabetta Gotera, chatting from Trentino in Northern Italy. Next on the show, a segment from Travel Bites Radio, based in Northern Ireland, and David Gordon, the host of that show, is actually visiting Rhode Island in Newport. That's the place, Newport, Rhode Island, on the east coast of the USA, where he paid a visit to the Newport Museum of Irish History.
History. The museum was founded in 1996 by Mr. Vince Arnold. This particular interpretive center here in the Fifth Ward in Newport opened in 2011, so we're in basically our fifth or sixth year. The museum tells the story of the Irish emigration from Ireland into Newport and Newport County, and the contributions of the Irish in building Newport. They were actually city builders here. They were nation builders. They came here to work, and the museum basically commemorates the working Irish in Newport, and we can talk a little bit, on the other hand, of some of the wealthy Irish in Newport. But they arrived, the records go back to the 1600s. We have some records of the Irish at Trinity Episcopalian Church in downtown Newport, because there was no Catholic Church at the time. The first Catholic Church was 1828 in Newport. In the 1700s, more Irish came, including Bishop Berkeley, who preached at Trinity Episcopalian Church, or Anglican Church. The 1800s, they started coming in numbers, and behind me is a board excuse me, that depicts the Portsmouth coal miners. The first Irish in numbers arrived here in 1810, and for 100 years, they mined the Portsmouth coal mines. They came from Alahis on the Barra Peninsula in County Cork. And then around the museum, as you look at the various walls here, it describes truly the Irish contributions to building Newport. The canal diggers that arrived in the 1820s to dig the Blackstone Canal, the Farmington Canal in Connecticut, the Erie Canal in Pennsylvania. And after the canals, it was principally Irish labor that built the Transcontinental Railroad, stretching from here to Promontory Point, Ogden, near Ogden, Utah. Locally, they worked in the textile mills along this very street, Thames Street. There were four mills. There were still two of them left, beautifully restored mills on Thames Street. They also, behind me is a board that depicts the Fall River Line, the 15 steamship line during the Gilded Age. For 90 years, it was principally Irish labor that that worked the waterfront here, repairing the ships. It was the Irish on board the Fall River Line that were the servants, the cooks. So for 90 years, again, the Irish participated in the Fall River steamship line. In the mid-1800s, the wall over here talks about Fort Adams. For 33 years, from 1824 to 1857, up to 400 Irish constructed Fort Adams. And that was at the time, and still is, the largest coastal defense fortification in the United States post-War of 1812. In the latter part of the 1800s, up to around 2,000 Irish worked in the mansions up on Bellevue Ave. And at that particular time, that's when they also started moving into and residing right here in the Fifth Ward, and that's the reason that the museum is located here. This is still principally Irish heaven down here, if you will, in the Fifth Ward. And the museum is a tribute to those workers, to their building of Newport. As persecuted as the Irish were when they arrived here, by 1895, we had our first Irish mayor, Patrick Boyle. And he is the first of 15 Irish mayors up to today, where we have Mayor Harry Winthrop. So it's a real story of although heavily persecuted originally, is how they were embraced by the Newport community and the contributions to building this great town of ours, Newport, Rhode Island. The Irish, of course, religion and church is very, very important to the Irish. I mentioned earlier that when they first arrived, we did not have a Catholic church in Newport until 1828. The early marriages that were recorded at Trinity Episcopalian Church. In 1828 was the first Irish community here, St. Joseph's Parish, in an old schoolhouse located at the site now of the Barney Street Cemetery, a beautifully restored Irish cemetery in the heart of downtown Newport, right behind, interestingly enough, Toro Synagogue. And I'll get back to that in a minute. Following St. Joseph's Church in 1852, we have a beautiful model here of St. Mary's Church, dedicated in 1852. The foundation was built through Irish labor on their off hours from building Fort Adams. They arrived at the church. It was a requirement then for Irish men to contribute labor to the church, and they did so in building the foundation. The church is an absolutely magnificent tribute to the Irish and Catholicism. Stands here today. This model was a gift of Father Chris Von Molusky, the pastor of St. Mary's Church. It was also the site of, in 1953, the marriage of President John F. Kennedy and Jacqueline Bouvier. So the church has a very significant historical meaning as well as a very significant religious meaning. Now, I mentioned, that behind Toro Synagogue, another interesting story, the Rabbi Emeritus of Toro Synagogue is Rabbi Theodore Lewis, a Dublin-born Irish Jew, who served here many, many years, died in 1910, still listed as the Rabbi Emeritus, and he headed up the largest Jewish congregation in Dublin, Ireland, prior to his arrival here in Newport. It's absolutely, it's another beautiful building. I think the year was 1763, the first synagogue in the United States. Again, beautifully restored, within 1/2 mile walk of St. Mary's Church, and behind it is the Barney Street Cemetery, worth a stop. This museum, the Museum of Newport Irish History, is the caretaker of that cemetery, and we put a lot of volunteer labor and care into maintaining the cemetery.
And that was David Gordon's segment from Rhode Island, Newport, Rhode Island, on the U.S. East Coast. We heard from Mike Sleen, the manager of the Newport Museum of Irish History. Next on the show, we will feature a segment from Travel Writers Radio, which is based in Melbourne, Australia. And the host of the show, Graham Kemlow, is chatting with cruise guru Caroline Jasinski.
Travel Writers Radio today welcomes back one of its regular members and contributors from South Australia, Caroline Jasinski. G'day, Caroline.
G'day, Graham. How are you?
Yeah, good. Now, cruise guru. That's a new title in your CV.
Yeah, I'm adding a few.
Travel writer. You were a technical guru at News Limited until you sort of did yourself out of a job, I think.
Yeah.
You're an author. You've written apps. I mean, you're probably a choir girl. I don't know about that. But what are you doing? What's the cruise guru bit? Tell us about this gig.
Well, the latest gig since I left News is I'm a cruise guest speaker.
Right.
It's kind of a natural fit, isn't it?
You're not bad at talking.
Yeah, love a chat. And when you're on a cruise ship, you've got a captive audience. So it's fabulous. I get up there and I get to just show off, basically.
Yeah, okay. Well, that's all very well, but what do you actually say to them, that people are prepared to invite you on their ship, and I assume wine and dine and whatever else they do for you, and let you loose on their passengers? How do you get away with it?
Well, it's part of the entertainment package, so okay. I'm one of the entertainers on board. So you get invited on board either as a destination speaker or an enrichment speaker. So destination speakers talk about, obviously, where you're going, but it's not the nitty-gritty port talks about, you know, how many steps to get up to this site and what time the bus leaves. It's more about the background and the culture about the places you're visiting.
Okay.
And in enrichment speaking is virtually anything from... Oh, I talk about how to write travel journals and what to do with them, whether you want to write a blog or have a very arty, creative, personal travel journal, photography, travel trivia. But with the enrichment, you have to pitch the ideas, and you pitch the ideas before you go on board, and then the cruise line says yay or nay whether they want them. It's kind of like pitching the book idea, I guess.
Okay. So you've chosen the enrichment angle, have you?
I do both.
Right.
I've done destination speaking to New Zealand, and I talked all about, you know, how New Zealand came about and the legend of Maui. And then I've done enrichment speaking on a South Pacific cruise. And the last one I did was part of a world cruise from Sydney to Dubai. That was a long haul. That was 19 days.
Yeah, and you told me quite a number of those days were at sea.
There were 16 of those at sea, so I had to give 10 talks.
Okay.
And well, sounds daunting, but once you get up on stage, I can't get enough of it.
You mean you don't go into your number when you open the fridge door, do you?
Sorry, Mr.
When the lights go on, when you open the fridge door and the lights go on, you don't start performing, do you?
Well, it was very rough on the last trip.
Right.
And I was on board and the ship was reeling and I had to kind of compromise and hang on tight. Then when I didn't hang on, I was giving line dancing lessons.
Were
you?
Because
I was just, I was thrown from one side of the stage to the other, so I just ad-libbed a bit and did a bit of line dancing and then assumed the semi-squat position.
Right.
And that's not very attractive, but it kept me on stage and it made everybody laugh, so it worked.
Oh. And so you really weren't feeling too good on that ocean crossing. It's the Indian Ocean you were going over, yeah?
Yes, I actually got sick going across the bight.
Right.
And found my leg, sea legs, about Fremantle. But when you're sick, it doesn't matter. You've just got to keep going. And it was very rough.
It's a terrible feeling.
Oh, it's shocking. That's one of my other talks I give on board. That's how to survive and thrive on a cruise.
Right.
And it's a funny talk, which is, well, I'm glad people laugh at the right moment. And part of that is how to cope with seasickness, you know, what to do. Other things, I tell people how to do things well. That's how to eat well, and that's a no-brainer, and how to drink well, that's a no-brainer for Aussies as well.
Yeah.
How to dress well, and that doesn't mean, you know, you get dressed up. The ladies have to think stretch material.
Right.
And the men, it's the general rule is untuck.
Untuck, okay.
Untuck. Don't
go on there looking like a mammal.
That's right. And if you tuck your shirt in, you just look like you're bragging about testing every boutique beer on board. So,
oh,
yeah.
Okay. Well, you've certainly got an interesting mix in your repertoire now. So, how did you start with this cruising? You've done quite a number of cruises before you were a cruise guru.
Yeah, I've done about 15 now. I've started purely as a passenger, and then I just got hooked. But everyone since then I have done as part of my work, if you can call it that.
Yeah.
Written travel stories about all of them, and that goes from, you know, cruise with kids when they were little, when they were grown up. That's completely different cruising. Bunch of friends. I've done romantic cruises on tall sailing ships, and now it's speaking on them. So, I've hosted one as well. That's an interesting angle.
When you say hosted, what do you mean?
I had 30 people. I was hosting a cruise for a group of passengers.
Just
a
small group on a big ship, or a
30 people was my group on a normal cruise ship of about 2,000.
Okay.
So I only had 30 to look after.
Right.
That was for a travel agent. That was Phil Hoffman Travel.
Okay. Well, that's interesting.
But
now, what do you actually get to do all the stuff that passengers do, or do you have to play like a crew member and go and hide in your cabin when you're not on stage?
No, you get to be, it's a bit of a mixed bunch. You go on as crew, but you're treated as partly crew, partly passenger. So while I'm working, and I've kind of had to represent the ship, I guess, so you have to behave yourself.
Yeah, you don't wear a uniform.
No, but you have to, you know, there's a dress code. You have to dress nicely.
Right.
But I get to do everything else. I get to mingle with passengers and, you know, you are basically one of the passengers except when you're working. And then when we stop at ports, sometimes I host tours as well. Like I might be an escort on the tour.
That's not a term I'd use if I were you.
Okay, a guide.
Yeah. People might get the wrong idea from another nation.
Yeah, I don't get paid for doing that bit.
Yeah. So tell me, in all the cruises you've done, and I know you've been to Antarctica, what's the sort of searing memory in your brain of, you know, a magnificent thing you saw or experienced on board a ship?
Oh, well, the Antarctic, oh, that was just amazing. That's more of an expedition than a cruise, even though it's sold as a cruise. Whales. I really wanted to see whales.
Right.
And we saw lots and lots of them. The best experience was we had three humpback whales playing with us. They were going underneath the ship, and then they'd come up the other side and come out of the water vertically and check us out. And then there's the Arctic. I went to the Arctic on another expedition, and that we were chasing polar bears. We saw 19 of those, but they didn't want to play with us. They just wanted to eat us.
So whereabouts in the Arctic were you?
We went to Svalbard. We circumnavigated Spitsbergen, so that's
right.
North of Norway.
Yeah,
it's part of Norway. So you go up there, and there's a group of islands, and it's about as far north as you can go. I believe it can go further, of course, but not so many cruise ships or expedition ships go up there. Absolutely fabulous. From that one, though, I did a. I wasn't speaking on that. I was writing stories, but I did an online daily diary. So I guess it's like a forerunner to blogging nowadays, really.
Yeah.
I hate the term blogging, but
yeah.
So I was writing a journal, basically, online, and that was telling people everything about the Arctic, how to get there, all about the history, the explorers, the wildlife. Again, it was such a huge learning curve. Those expeditions are more about education, and they're fabulous.
Mm. No, that sounds fantastic. But I do love this gig you've got, you know, where you get to speak, and obviously they look after you.
Obviously they do look after you, cut you off short. That's a bit rough, isn't it? That was Carolyn Jasinski, travel writer, cruise guru, and we'll hear more from Carolyn in coming weeks. She's going to talk about the threat of piracy on the high seas. It's something I don't think cruise passengers are aware of, but something they actually need to take quite seriously.
A segment from Travel Writers Radio, learning all about cruising from Caroline Jasinski. Thank you to Graham Kemlow, the host and producer of that show. And the final segment coming up now, Around the World Travel TV, produced in the studios in Santa Barbara in California, and seen on cable TV and free-to-air TV in California. We'll grab a segment which was featured recently on that show, and their guest was Ivor Davis. Ivor has written a very interesting book about his experiences during his Liverpool days of touring with the Beatles. Here's Arthur von Wiesenberger, Martha Buller and Rebecca Brand with Ivor Davis.
And we're back here on Around the World. I'm Arthur von Wiesenberger with the gorgeous, the stunning, the fabulous Arthur von Wiesenberger. Oh, and Martha Bull. Hello, Martha Bull. Good to have you back. And joining us, one of our favorite girls in the world, Rebecca Brand of Rebecca Brand Recipes.
Hi,
Rebecca.
To be here.
So good to have you on board with us, too. You know, we've been having a lot of fun here on Around the World, and fun doesn't stop because, you know, we got some great folks who call in. One of our favorite correspondents is joining us. He is a legend. In his own mind. No, he's a legend in everyone's mind. He has written for the Daily Express, for many newspapers and magazines. He's an author, a bon vivant, a world traveler, and a dear friend. And he's live in Ventura, California. Joining us is Ivor Davis. Hello, Ivor.
Hi, good afternoon and good day to the lovely ladies and Arthur.
I'm glad you're not saying the lovely ladies. One named Arthur. But anyway, because I'm not that lovely. But Ivor, you are always such the great globetrotter, and I understand you just came back from a place that, honestly, I didn't think many people went to. I mean, they all go to England, but not that many people go to Liverpool. What That's brought right. you to Liverpool?
Well, it's funny you should ask, because, you know, I want to tell you that now, that 25 years ago or more, nobody went to Liverpool. But now they're all going to Liverpool and ignoring London. Well, almost.
Huh.
And the reason I went to Liverpool was to track down the childhood homes of a couple of Liverpool lads who came to America in 1964 and were very successful with a singing group, and I can't quite remember the name of the singing group.
They were singing after some sort of bug.
Yeah,
they?
Right, exactly.
Yeah, I mean, this was a group who did very well in America and has continued to do well, believe it or not. But can you help me with their name?
Well, you know,
the Beatles.
I'm glad you mentioned the name, which is, of course, we all know the Beatles.
Like making a cake.
Yeah.
Beat.
But yeah, you know what? There are people who spell the Beatles' name even to this day as B-E-E-T-L-E-S, not as B-E-A-T-L-E-S.
Thinking of the bug.
Well, I should tell you this very, very quickly to interrupt. When the Beatles' first record came out in America by a small record company, not Capitol Records, they spelt the name wrong. So it's not difficult.
So Liverpool has become a destination because it is the home of the Beatles.
Well, what has happened is that I would say in the last 25 years, Liverpool has become an incredible destination for a lot of Americans and from people all over the world, because that's where the Beatles grew up. And as a result of this absolutely passionate interest in the Beatles, people, millions of people are going to Liverpool. And it was never a big destination. And I want to tell you that when you get to Liverpool, it's phenomenal. There's museums. There's now, last week, four new statues went up in the main town square. 6'7" tall. The Beatles were never that tall, believe me. And all over the place, it's Beatles, Beatles everywhere. And Liverpool is finally cashing in hugely on these Liverpool Fab Four guys.
Isn't Liverpool mainly a shipping port?
Yes, Liverpool used to be a rather sleazy port in the days when John, Paul, George and Ringo grew up there. It has now become very fashionable, high-rise building, hotels. I stayed at the Jury's Inn, J-U-R-Y-S, in minutes, steps from the museums, and it didn't rain, which helps.
Yeah.
And I want to tell you that the whole Beatle imprint is formidable, amazing, because I want to tell you, 25 years ago, it was minute. In the last quarter of a century, Liverpool has actually boomed as, of course, the home of the Beatles.
Now, we were just looking at a photograph of a house that looks like a typical council house, inexpensive little house. Was that where one of the Beatles was born?
Yes, yes. Now, I don't know which house you're looking at.
It's green. Let me tell you. It was green.
Yeah, I mean, the Beatles grew up in very ordinary circumstances. And I went back, and what you're seeing is a picture of John Lennon's house and Paul McCartney's house. Now, Paul McCartney's house was much lower class than John. But John grew up in Aunt Mimi's house, and it was supposed to be middle class. Now you can go back to Liverpool, and you can visit the houses, you can go into the houses, thanks to the National Trust, which is the government's National Historic Association, which bought the two Beatles' homes and now does tours of the houses. And I would say that if anybody goes to Liverpool, that is a special treat.
Huh. How far is Liverpool from London? And is it, do you just take the train?
It is 2 hours and 15 minutes, 150 miles by train from central London, Euston Station. You get on the train, you have a little snack, and by the time you finish your snack, you're rolling into Liverpool in the heart of the city, and it's an easy, easy train ride. Most people take the train. You can drive, of course, but, you know, like any big city, driving in London is pretty awful, as it is in L.A. and as it is in all the places that you guys have been, I'm sure, over the last few years.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Wow.
Yeah.
Now, how's the food in Liverpool? I hope they serve things other than liver and kidney pie.
Thankfully enough, when the Beatles were kids, and you know, I don't know if I mentioned, but I knew them back in the 60s, so much so that I actually traveled with them on their first American tour. Did I ever mention that, Arthur?
You know, that's enough to write a book about.
Yes.
And by the way,
it so happened...
We're holding the book right here on our airplane. It's a good read in flight or anywhere. It's called The Beatles and Me on Tour by Ivor Davis.
Yes.
a friend of Arthur von Weisenberger's. No, I mean, he didn't say that.
With a little help from my friends, right?
Yeah. What was that about, by the way, a little help with my friends? Was that to do with drugs?
Well, you know, I want to tell you this about the Beatle music. There's a lot of songs like Lucy in the Sky with Diamonds, with a little help from my friends, that could have been drug-oriented. But I want to tell you that on the Beatles tour that I went on, the Beatles actually took drugs. I mean, they took uppers and they took marijuana. But, you know, marijuana is okay today. Now it's kosher, isn't it?
Yeah, that's what they tell me.
I drink lattes every day. That's an upper.
What was that? I missed that line.
Rebecca says she drinks uppers every day.
Every day.
Oh, lattes.
Oh, lattes.
Yeah.
My liquid upper.
Let me just explain why the Beatles, the drug habit of uppers, was normal. Because don't forget, before they became famous, before they came to America in 1964, they actually performed in Germany from 11 p.m. at night until 8 o'clock in the morning. I mean, if you stay awake, if you have to stay awake, you need a little help from some pills to keep you up and awake and singing. And that's what was the basis of the Beatles' background.
Wow.
Interesting.
Okay, now, by the way, you know, to our viewers who might be watching this on TVSB or listening to it on AM 1290, we're now also streaming live on Rebecca Brand Recipes Facebook page, and we're getting people who are watching this broadcast behind the scenes right now.
Has a camera
live
there.
In Santa Barbara, and we have some people that are asking questions. There's a viewer named Mary Stark, and she asks, is the book available on Audible?
On Audible.
Yeah.
Well, the answer is, I'm trying to get round to reading it, but it is available on ebook and it is available on Amazon. Just go onto Amazon, get the book, and it's my inside story of my travels with the Fab Four in a wonderful time in rock and roll history that was just unbelievable. So yes, you can get it, and please do.
And we just had a lovely picture of the Fab Four sculpture, and you in the middle.
Yeah,
and
they're towering.
Ivory was going up to his knees. What was, I mean, Ivory was up as his knees.
Oh, well, you know.
They said they're 6 feet seven.
They're big boys.
Oh, they're really big.
They're bigger than life.
I mean, keep this to yourself. The Beatles were never 6 foot seven. Okay? The Beatles were 2 inches taller than me, and I am a giant at 5 foot five.
So
now,
they
the
were
Beatles
big,
were under
yeah.
6 feet tall.
That's great.
You know, when I lived in New York, and I remember when they performed on the Ed Sullivan Show back in 1964,
yes.
My brother got to go to that.
Really?
Yeah. Uh-huh.
Wow,
live in person, because his...
Yeah, now that's Martha. Is that you, Martha? Because
yes.
I can't quite see you through the haze.
From all that
yeah,
marijuana
Martha.
Smoke?
Yeah, well, exactly. You know, you're right. I mean... That was the start of the big thing.
Mm-hmm.
They appeared on the Ed Sullivan Show. It was a sensation. And as a result of them being sensational on the Ed Sullivan Show, they came back. Brian Epstein, their very canny manager, brought them back in August of 1964 for the first American tour, which is the one I went on. And that was the start of Beatlemania in America.
And didn't they perform at Yankee Stadium?
Here's what happened. They first of all, in 1964, for the Perfectionists, they performed at the New York Tennis Club. But then in the following year, they have performed at Shea Stadium.
That's right.
To a huge crowd of about 55,000, and that was the big time. Shea Stadium was huge.
Yeah, they made a lot of money. That was a lot of money in that show, wasn't there?
Oh, I mean, it was huge. But let me tell you one other thing. Because I went to every concert in America, I could not hear a single word they sang, and guess why?
The Screaming Girls.
Yes.
She wins. You win a book. Congratulations.
Thank you, Ivor.
That segment from Around the World Travel TV featuring Ivor Davis talking about his book, The Beatles and Me on Tour. Thank you to all the contributors to this month's show, because that's all we have for you. We'd like to say a hearty thank you to Jeff Harrison and his guest Elizabeth Gutierrez, David Gordon and his guest Mike Sleen, also Graham Kemlow with Caroline Jasinski, and of course the team in the US, Arthur von Wiesenberger, Martha Ball and Rebecca Brand with Ivor Davis. We'll be back with another edition, both in audio and video, of Travel Radio Australia next month. So until then, happy trails.